Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
War, they say, is hell. It is also, for a fact, really expensive. How the Iraqi militants are paying for it on the broadcast today. Also, we're going to revisit an interview with Donald Rumsfeld. Yes, that Donald Rumsfeld. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you here on this 13th day of June, everybody. It is a Friday today. Oil prices continued their upward swing this afternoon. Crude closed up 5% for the week in New York, $107.10 a barrel, if you're looking for specifics. The proximate cause, of course, being the events in northern Iraq, where the militant group ISIL, that is the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, has been on the march. The Sunni insurgents have taken the major oil hub of Mosul in the north, as well as Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown. They are 70 miles more or less from Baghdad. And as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, they are getting richer every mile.
Multiple reports from the region say ISIL forces busted into the central bank as they swept through Mosul, grabbing somewhere north of $425 million in cash and gold.
For this organization, this is such a major windfall.
Rick Brennan is a retired Army officer and senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation. He says almost half $1 billion will buy a lot on the battlefield.
Arms, ammunition, paying for foreign fighters, increasing salaries, enables them to transform themselves from just an insurgent group to almost having a small army, which is something that we haven't seen before.
Every war takes finance, and they're quite good at extracting finance to fund their war.
Austin Long teaches international affairs at Columbia University and served as a consultant to the U.S. military in Iraq. He says since the mid-2000s, ISIL has operated in some ways like a business.
These guys are good businessmen. They made a lot of money from seizing various legal and illegal enterprises. They kept very good detailed records. You know, they had very sophisticated ways of not only taxation, but things like stealing cars and then reselling them in Kurdistan where they knew they could get better prices.
ISIL forces have overrun oil pipelines and export facilities, but they're still far from taking over the major oil fields defended by the Iraqi government in the south and the Kurds in the north. And experts say ISIL would be hard-pressed to actually run oil production facilities, even if it could win them on the battlefield. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We're going to pick up on Mitchell's story and roll right on into our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. Here to do that with us are Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal and Neela Richardson from Redfin. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So you both heard Mitchell's story. Sudeep, what do you think? Other than oil prices, is this going to take a chunk out of anything economy-wise for us? The markets clearly don't care, right?
The markets clearly don't care. The markets clearly haven't cared about a whole lot for a while, even weak economic data for much of the year. So they're looking for – they're certainly on the watch for any trouble out there. But you look over the past year, you've seen potential trouble in Iraq. You've seen potential trouble in Syria. You've seen potential trouble in Russia and Ukraine. And the markets have been able to brush that off pretty easily. And it's certainly possible they can brush this off now, though it's clear that this situation is worse. And doesn't have a very clear outcome anytime soon.
Oil prices on the rise, Neela, eventually lead to gas prices on the rise. There comes a point where the American public begins to pay attention, right?
Yes, the American public will pay attention much faster than the markets will. And we've seen gas prices be basically pretty stable and high. And now with this uncertainty, they're about to become unstable and higher. And so consumers, as they gas up their cars for their summer vacation, we'll take notice.
All right. We booked you guys on purpose because you are in Washington, the center of the political universe this week with Eric Cantor and David Brad and that whole primary thing on Tuesday night. What do you foresee, Sudeep, on the issues of import to us on this broadcast? That is to say, the economy, budget stuff, the debt limit fight, which is coming next March.
If you were expecting, Kai, to see something positive from Washington this year, you were already pretty crazy. The environment is certainly marginally worse than it was a week ago for anything positive to come out of Washington, anything even relatively modest to come out of Washington. But come on, look at this place. It's been pretty awful the last few years.
Yep.
No one was really looking for some big achievement from anyone in the Capitol or the White House. The big question is whether anything will get done in 2015 and 2016, right, which is a big, much bigger deal. And that's what this election is going to be all about, whether the status quo will continue or whether we'll see some kind of much bigger shakeup.
Well, exactly. And Neil, you know, the reason I asked about the debt limit, is that that comes up again in March of next year. Yes, there's an election in between, but it does not look like there will be compromise, and thus we will have credit rating downgrade talk and all of that stuff.
You know, we lost a deal maker. Now, he wasn't a frequent deal maker, but at least
in debt ceiling,
right? He was a deal maker. And so there are three potential scenarios. There's a good solution where the debt ceiling is extended with the budget. There's a will-do solution where it's just extended for a short term. Yeah. And then there's this catastrophic, not a solution, where you see this kind of thing where markets go crazy and we don't know what happens next.
All right, fair enough. A brief macroeconomic question for you both. It has to do with inflation or possibly deflation. Sudeep, this morning, the producer price index, that is prices at the wholesale level, came out. They fell in contrast to everybody's expectations. When and what will it take to get price rises coming in this economy?
That is the big question. We've seen inflation remain weak for years and years. You're seeing consumer prices remain relatively weak. We thought this would be the big year of the recovery, the year when inflation picks up, the year when wages accelerate. That hasn't happened, and it's probably not going to happen in a big, meaningful way anytime soon, as long as you've got the job market as weak as it is.
I have one answer. One word. Growth. It takes growth to produce some price increases, and we just haven't seen it.
And let's all remember GDP actually fell last quarter. All right. Neela Richardson from Redfin, Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. They are in our bureau in Washington, the nation's capital. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you, Kai.
All right. We'll see you. Have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, not so bad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We turn now to the mergers and acquisitions portion of the broadcast. Item number one, Priceline, the travel booking site, is going to spend $2.6 billion for OpenTable, a company that does online restaurant reservations. The temptation with these kinds of digital mobile savvy deals is to say that it's all about the future, wherever the industry in question is headed. This one, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith explains, is about the past of the travel business.
It used to be when you were booking a trip, you went to a travel agent. They'd help you plan your itinerary and they'd know things like the cool neighborhood to stay in or a cute bistro you should try.
The travel agent is making a comeback.
Steve Cohen is with MMGY Global. He says baby boomers and millennials are gravitating back to travel agents, putting convenience and expertise ahead of price. To compete, says Cohen, travel sites have to be a place where customers can research and plan their entire trip.
A very large percentage of travelers like to have most of their vacation planned before they ever get there.
Right now, on most travel sites, you can book a flight, hotel, and rental car. But that's still missing most of the trip and the money, says industry analyst Henry Hartefelt.
As much as 60% of a traveler's budget is actually spent in their destination, dining, shopping, entertainment. The online travel companies are saying, let's see how much of the rest of the budget we can sink our teeth into.
And they're well positioned to do that, says Douglas Quinby with Focusrite. Priceline already knows where its customers are going and when. With OpenTable, it will know what they like to eat.
They can start to make recommendations. Well, we see that you like Italian. We know you're going to be in New York.
Most important, travel sites know where you live, says Henry Hartefelt.
It really turns them into this lifestyle utility that also could be used when we're at home. Here's a great new store that opened in your city.
Hartefelt says we travel on average 3 times per year, but explore the cities and towns we live in all year. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
From travel and dining to online gambling now, and no, that was not the most elegant of segues, but it's going to have to do. I apologize, because there was a big deal today in the world of online gaming. Amaya, a small Canadian company, is buying Oldford, the parent outfit to some of the most popular gambling brands out there, like PokerStars and Full Tilt Poker. They, that is PokerStars and some of the others, have been banned in this country. But as Dan Bobkoff explains, this deal could help bring them back.
Starting in the mid-90s, online poker was a free-for-all, and sites like PokerStars are making players like Chris Carlsen rich.
I started making so much money from playing online that I left my really well-playing secure job to go play professionally, and I played most of my hands at PokerStars.
But in 2006, the Justice Department said a 60s-era law banned many online gaming transactions. Sites like PokerStars started operating in a kind of gray market and started crossing some lines, says Mark Hickar, chairman of the gaming law practice group at Hinckley Allen. Things like
incorrectly code the transactions so they were not obvious to the credit card issuers as gambling transactions.
PokerStars allegedly labeled some as golf purchases. There's another way to put this.
Fraud and money laundering.
That was the accusation against top officials at PokerStars and other sites on a day in 2011 that became known as Black Friday. PokerStars quickly left the U.S. Popularity in online poker plummeted. Funny enough, later that year, the Justice Department ruled that states can legalize online gambling. New Jersey, Delaware, and Nevada did, but kept PokerStars out while its officials remained indicted or under suspicion. That's why it's a big deal they're leaving the combined company, says Christopher Grove of Online Poker Report.
Given that this deal basically results in the removal of all of those entities from PokerStars as a corporate entity, it seems as if New Jersey regulators won't have any objection to PokerStars now entering the market.
He says this deal could be the start of a new era of online poker in the U.S. I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
This was a big week for student loan news. On Monday, President Obama signed an executive order expanding eligibility for a program that caps student loan payments at 10% of a person's income. On Wednesday, Senate Republicans filibustered a bill that would have let more people refinance their student debt to lower interest rates. A new documentary film opens in New York and Los Angeles today, examining the question that is kind of at the root of the whole student loan and student debt story. Is college worth it? The film is called Ivory Tower. Andrew Rossi is the producer and the director. Andrew, thanks for coming in.
Great to be here. Thank you.
We should probably stipulate right at the outset that college tuition is way more expensive than it used to be, way more expensive than anybody ever thought it probably would be. And yet there is still the drive in this country to send so many people to college. How is that tenable? How is that sustainable?
Well, you know, the truth is that higher education is still an engine of social mobility, even as it has grown so expensive. So we see in the film that those who have a college degree, a BA, actually make in their median lifetime earnings about $1 million more than those who only have a high school diploma. And that's a really powerful statistic that helps to drive the continued demand. However, there are a lot of other mitigating factors, mm-hmm. like student loan debt and poor completion rates, that complicate the question of whether college is still worth it.
Is it fair to say that higher education in this country has become corporatized a little bit?
I think so. And I think that's what many of the folks that we speak to in the film believe, that in an effort to compensate for a reduction in state funding, in an effort to bring students and their student loan dollars to their campuses, many institutions are behaving like big businesses rather than treating their students as pupils. And this has gotten us to a point where tuition is rising at a rate of 1,120% since 1978.
That brings up a related issue, and you touch on this sort of tangentially in the film. You don't directly address it. The idea of, are these kids students or are they consumers and customers? Because that's a tricky thing, right?
Absolutely. I think that's a really fundamental point of the film, that increasingly institutions are treating the students as customers, and their parents as well feel that because they are paying so much money, because the bill is in some cases $60,000, that when they get on campus, they're entitled to almost customer service. And unfortunately, we see that bleeds into the classroom too.
This shift from student to consumer, when did that happen? I mean, can you pinpoint it?
Well, what we see in the film is that in the late 60s and 70s, higher education came to be seen as a private good rather than a public good. conservative governors at that time, like Ronald Reagan, for example, claimed that the government or the state should not be involved in subsidizing intellectual curiosity. And at that point, institutions realized, well, I'm not getting money anymore from the state, so I've got to get it from the student. And so this competition emerges in which schools are trying to attract the student loan dollar.
You got the president of Harvard, the president of the University of Virginia, the president of Wesleyan, I think. I mean, you had a bunch of administrators out there sit down with you. I'm wondering what they said when you asked them why tuition is so doggone high.
Well, President Roth of Wesleyan agrees that this idea that tuition is $60,000 for schools of his tier is astronomical and troubling. And in fact, he has agreed to cap tuition at Wesleyan and peg it to the rate of inflation. A lot of the expense has gone to administrations, which have ballooned since 1978 at a rate of 240%, while faculty instruction and the cost thereto has only increased by 40%. There are many projects on campuses that are being done and require the schools to actually go into debt that have no relation to the academic rigor of the institution or indeed any academic activity at all.
Rising student debt loads, over $1 trillion, as has been widely reported, are and have been said to be the next big economic bubble that's going to happen in this country, right? That's the next big thing that's going to send us over the economic cliff. What happens if we don't fix it? What happens if we don't get the higher education puzzle right?
Well, one of the most devastating consequences would be a sort of macroeconomic one, which is that when young people are saddled with that kind of burden, they decide not to form a family, not to buy a house, not to buy a car. It's not just about a constriction of life choices in terms of career and happiness, but it has broader macroeconomic effects on the country. I think that that's something that President Obama was discussing when he made his executive action this week. And that's one of the key problems.
Andrew Rossi is the producer and director of a new documentary about higher education in this country. It is called Ivory Tower. Andrew, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, you recognize this voice?
It's not easy for countries to evolve and grow.
From the archives, former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld in just a minute. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 41 points today, 0.25%, finished at 16,775. The NASDAQ up 13 points, 0.3%, 4310 there. The S&P 500 put on 6 points, 0.3%, finished at 1936. For the week, the Dow pulled back 0.9%. The NASDAQ deleted 0.25%. The S&P 500 slid about 0.7%. Sales of workplace computers, actual PCs, believe it or not, are on the rise. That is according to Intel, which uploaded a 7% gain. Hewlett-Packard added 5% on that news. Remember that OpenTable deal we were talking about? OpenTable got a 48% upgrade today. Priceline, however, tumbled 3%. Bond prices also down. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.60%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported program, and your support in any amount helps us keep on telling the stories behind the business and economic news of the day. So please help us end our budget year strong by giving at marketplace.org by June 30.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve reports on industrial production for May. The State Department hosts a two-day Our Ocean Conference on protecting the vast bodies of water that cover almost three-quarters of our planet. And in Michigan, on June 16, 1903, Ford Motor Company was incorporated. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back in May of last year, I did an interview that we were thinking might be worth playing again today, given what's going on over in Iraq. Former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld had a new book out back then called Rumsfeld's Rules, Leadership Lessons in Business, Politics, War, and Life. Quotes and sayings that he has collected through the years, a guide of sorts to how he thinks and how he makes decisions. So the first thing I asked him was about the list itself.
Rumsfeld's Rules, I started collecting because my mom was a school teacher. And I was a youngster, and if I didn't know the meaning of a word, she'd say, well, write it down and look it up. And then I started writing down various other thoughts and rules and ideas and anecdotes. And so I've always carried a 3x5 card, and I've got now, I think, close to 300 rules, and they're not all mine, obviously. They're from people a lot smarter than I am.
There are, as you said, 300-something odd of them in here, and I'm just going to pull a couple out and run them by and get your thoughts. So let's start with this one. It's easier, you say, to get into something than it is to get out of it. And I can't help but wonder where we would be in this country today if you guys had been thinking of that 10 years ago.
Well, I thought of that actually when I was President Reagan's Middle East envoy, and we had 241 Marines killed in Beirut at the airport. And I concluded then that the United States has to be careful about putting ground forces in because we're such a big target. And I also, over the years, came to the conclusion that the United States really wasn't organized, trained, and equipped to do nation building. So if you think of Afghanistan...
Wait, hang on a minute. I sort of can't believe these words are coming out of your mouth now 10 years later. So this was on your mind as Iraq was burbling up?
Absolutely.
And yet here we are.
Well, in Afghanistan, we had 23,000 troops in there, as I recall, when I was there. And President Obama ran them up to close to 100,000. And the situation in Iraq, we had a relatively small footprint and changed the regime, which was the policy of the United States in the Clinton administration. But once you get a mission creep where people start attempting to do things well beyond that, that's obviously not something the Department of Defense is organized to do.
I will do you the favor, Mr. Secretary, of assuming that you're not trying to shift any kind of responsibility here.
Well, I'm not. It's just reality that when you do something, then someone wants you to do something else, and then something else. And over time, the mission is historically creeps into something other than was initiated at the outset.
And yet the primary critique, and I grant you, and as you well know, there have been many, the primary critique of the Bush administration in Iraq is that you guys went in without a plan to get out. And here we now are having a conversation where you say, yeah, I was thinking about all this stuff, but we went in anyway.
Well, go to my website, rumsfeld.com. You'll find 4,000 documents on there, and any number of them talk about these kinds of risks and problems. One of them was called The Parade of Horribles that I wrote well before the war and gave it to the president and the National Security Council members. It's not easy for countries to evolve and grow. But I think that both of those countries are a whale of a lot better off today than they were before. My book, of course, is not about Afghanistan.
No, of course it's not.
It's a bunch of rules.
Yeah, but you appreciate you can't have a conversation with Donald Rumsfeld about the rules he lives by without talking about these things, right?
Sure.
Yeah. All right, here's another one. You are known as a big proponent of measuring things, of knowing what you're trying to change and measuring and getting a grip on that change and assessing things. I want you to assess now yourself and your period in office as Secretary of Defense for the Bush administration. Go ahead.
Well, I'm thinking how one would do that. I think that history over time will probably be a better judge than you or I, but I've been struck by the amount of criticism that the Bush administration has received and President Bush personally, and the attempts to assign blame to him, and I think it's probably not going to sort out that way.
Others obviously disagree, and that's a conversation well beyond the scope of this interview and this broadcast, but I do wonder whether you read Robert McNamara's memoirs when they came out, obviously the Secretary of Defense during Vietnam.
Yeah, I have not. I served in Congress during that period.
All right. Well, here's why I ask. You know, that book was widely seen as an apology for his role in Vietnam. And I looked in this book pretty hard for any rule that you might have had about apologizing. And I couldn't find one.
And what's your question?
Did you ever think about apologizing?
Well, my goodness, as Napoleon said, I've been mistaken so many times I don't even blush for it anymore. Sure, you see things that don't turn out the way you hope. You look at intelligence, and of course, if intelligence were a fact, it wouldn't be intelligence. And the idea that people concluded that President Bush made a terrible mistake by doing it, I think, is something that over time will be better understood.
Former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld on the program, our conversation from May of last year. You can hear it again, if you like, at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which I am sad to have to report that the President of the United States of America has proven himself, well, shall we say, uninformed. The President, as you might have heard, did a town hall thing on Tumblr the other day. In the process, he met Tumblr founder David Karp, and they, it seems, did a fist bump in which a GIF was created, except, well, this happened. Listen for yourselves.
A GIF. I'm all on top of it.
There is. So you've made up your mind it's GIF?
That is my official position.
Here's the key bit again. Unless you missed it, it was lousy tape. Here you go.
A GIF.
It's a GIF, people, a GIF. I don't care if you're the president or the man in the moon. There's a link to that whole thing. You can see the whole video at marketplace.org. And that is the radio show Marketplace for this Friday. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. The program was developed by JJ Yore. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you on Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.